Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This week, it seems like everyone is talking about Brexit, with Jeremy Corbyn, David Lidington, Liam Fox, John Major and Theresa May all giving speeches. So we're going to talk about something else. Lessons in money, funding our old age and adults watching children's films. Don't forget to sign up to my free morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. It's like the podcast, but somebody's printed it out. This week, I'm joined in the studio by James Kirkup, Redbox regular columnist and head of the Social Market Foundation think tank on politicians avoiding the sensible choice. Times columnist David Aronovich is in a mood at the movies. But first, Times property and money editor Anne Ashworth on a new power failure.
The government is to impose a price cap on popular energy tariffs, but only from next winter. This is yet another reminder of an awkward truth. Households on these expensive tariffs are being penalised for their loyalty to a supplier. They are subsidising sharp-elbowed middle-class people who know that loyalty doesn't pay and routinely shop around for the best deal on energy, insurance, loans, whatever. It's about time we had financial literacy lessons in schools and at university, which taught us all to be active consumers, holding businesses and the government to account.
And it's particularly topical, of course, because we are bracing ourselves for the arrival of the beast from the east. The winter is going to bring cold weather, we're told. And so it's this week that the government has chosen to announce this plan to cap energy bills, but not in time for the current cold spell that we're going through.
And let's remember just exactly how much people pay for the average energy bill. It's around about £1,100, except if you've been switching in the last couple of weeks when you could have cut it to about £879. That's quite a big saving. But the people who do this are people like me and the readers of The Times, who are never that far from a price comparison site, always trying to get a really, really good deal. Whereas apathy reigns out there. Most people assume that their supplier will repay them for their loyalty. The reverse is true. And the sooner we all wake up to that, the better.
Is there not something that a traditional right-wing view about taking personal responsibility? You know, the options are there to switch. If you don't, then that's your lookout.
I think that people imagine it's all very complicated and they'll be jumping from the frying pan into the fire, say. Also, you need a certain amount of nerdy patience to sit on a price comparison site and recognise when the suppliers are trying to game each other on their pricing. Also referring to ratings on service, which is important with an energy supplier. So the advantage is all with the savvy consumer, of which there are many, but there are a great many more people out there who imagine it's too difficult and they won't necessarily save the amounts that are promised.
David, are you a savvy switcher?
No, I theoretically ought to fit the profile, shouldn't I? But I just cannot find myself bothered by this. I mean, personally, I might be bothered on the part of the people who are genuinely poor. I am much, much more concerned about, let's say, energy conservation. I'm incredibly aware that actually I could probably save a vast amount of money, whatever system I was working under, if I was to do some fairly kind of basic, ordinary things in order to insulate the house, etc., which is an old Victorian pile. And we are, I think, still one of the worst countries for energy conservation. Now, that doesn't mean that what Anne says is wrong. It just says, you say price comparison site. I hear the words price comparison site. By the time you get to the word site, I'm off the edge. Really. It's like, you know, I'm one of these people, and a lot of us, I haven't filled in any expenses in this place for a decade because I just cannot be bothered. I could just look at the bloody forms.
That's what an economist would call revealed preference. I mean, yeah, what that says is that actually you don't think it's worth your time. And actually, this is you're absolutely right. I mean, you could get a better deal, but you don't need one. And this is the problem with the whole switching agenda. And actually, I agree that it would be good to educate people, get everyone to switch a bit more. But the reality of markets, and this is, sorry, I'll try and get back on this too much because I do this for a living, is that you can make the market better. You can get everyone to switch a bit more. If all of us in this room switch more often, you go from twice a year, once every 2 years, once every year, we'll all get a better deal. The suppliers will maintain their margins. They will, yeah, and says absolutely rightly, yeah, they will call force loyal customers to subsidise us, our prices. And that's something that, you know, I think, you know, needs to be you.
What do we mean by loyal customers, if you don't mind me asking? Idea of loyalty to an energy supplier to be a completely ridiculous It's not like a football club, is it? I mean, you don't go down there with a kind of banner saying...
Right, you mock. Okay, you're absolutely right. We should probably shouldn't call them loyal. We should call them sticky or stuck or inert or something like that. It's quite rude.
Call them inert, and then you say, why would you reward inertia?
I've advertised my think tank, Social Market Foundation. We've done some research on this, and there are some people who genuinely do feel a bit of loyalty to their companies. And actually, particularly, this is a fun thing, there is a price premium that attaches to having British in your name. Or if you're in Scotland, or if in Wales, if you've got the national flag in your name somewhere, you'll probably have a bigger body of loyal customers. There are some people out there who basically will go, I don't know about this, I've got Ovo, Octopus, Energy 7, 15.com. I'll just go with British Gas, because, you know, they're British Gas, aren't they? There's that old memory that's there. And bluntly, those people, those companies are probably exploiting that brand and getting some more money out of their customers that they don't necessarily deserve. I kick around an idea that we should impose some sort of tax or licensing fee on the name British. They should pay some to the Queen for the use of her country's name or something. But some people are loyal to their energy company.
I think I've found the solution to this, because I've recently signed up with a site. No. Where you sign up with them once and they do all the flipping for you.
It's called Flipper.
They're called Sharp Elbow. Mm.
A man after my own heart. Really, you are.
So I'm doing what you're telling me to do, which is switching, but I'm being like David and I'm not doing it myself.
And this is where disruption is going to come into financial services. We've been tremendously apathetic about moving banks. People whine about their bank. Will they move? No. But there are coming in all these app-based banks that provide a much better service. And if you look in the wallets of your young colleagues, which I always do because it's a bit of market research.
They won't have wallets, they'll have phones.
They have cards from these new banks, which they feel are doing a better job for them. So whatever way we get there, I just feel we need to be better informed. We did a big event last week at Times Money with Martin Lewis, the money saving expert, trying to debunk all the myths about student loans. And the conversation turned to, why aren't they teaching more of this kind of stuff at university? And I think those are lessons for life that we definitely need.
Well, they're not teaching anything at university this week, are they? Because they're all on strike. But I take your point about, you know, young people and dynamic apps and all that sort of stuff. But isn't the problem that all that's going to do is reinforce the rump, the inert rump are going to get ripped off even more.
Yeah, and subsidising the rest in the way that there is millions of people who have not benefited from the era of low interest rates. While middle classes had the most extraordinary discounted mortgage deals, there were loads of people paying 23% or more, or 1,500% on credit cards. During the era of low interest rates, credit card charges actually went up. So again, the people who are less well-off subsidise the well-off middle classes.
You're absolutely right about the fintech revolution, all this clever banky stuff that will do it all for you. That's being aimed at people like us. It's not, those products are not for the people at the bottom. It will reinforce the... All I would say is that there is a sort of tech utopia out there that, don't worry, we can all tool up with AIs and turbocharged market intermediaries that will get us the best deal. Guess what? The suppliers are already doing it, and they're getting bigger, better, badder AIs than you're going to be able to buy. So they're trying to work out how to game Flipper and all the other intermediaries. That is the arms race of markets.
You're already damned, man. By the time you get out of here, they'll have done it.
By the time you've got a mobile to do it,
where's my inertia?
Just very quickly, what could or should the government be doing about this? Because obviously the Jeremy Corbyn solution to this problem is nationalise all the energy companies, and presumably he can decide what the prices that we pay. So what could the government be doing other than education?
Let us not get into the cost of renationalisation, which of the six biggest energy suppliers would be about $124 billion. I think I saw a figure today.
Says it won't be anything.
Well, that's up to him. I'm believing the source I read. I just feel that we need to empower our children from the earliest possible age so that they can get clever with money. And my one big tip is, if you want to get your child to recognise the value of money, never pay by contactless in front of them, because it's much better to count out the money, the change, so they recognise the price of everything. And I was told that by a billionaire about his way to get rich.
Well, every time Anne comes on, she lectures our listeners, so our listeners should be the most financially savvy.
It's advice.
No, it is advice. No, I was praising you. I wasn't complaining. I think this is what our listeners want. So hopefully you've got the message loud and clear. Get switching. Or if you've got as much money as David, just sit back and just let it all disappear out of your badly insulated house. Just chuck another bundle of 50s on the fire. Right, let's move on then to the dementia tax. This is James Kirker.
Never underestimate how far politicians will go to avoid doing something sensible. Damien Green, the former First Secretary of State, is back, and he says we should fund social care by raising national insurance. It's a daft idea, and it's dreamt up to avoid taking money from the most obvious place: Britain's £7 trillion of scandalously undertaxed housing wealth. There is a simple way of funding our elderly care: bring back the dementia tax.
So we won't dwell too long on the speed with which Damien Green has gone from scandal-hit resignation from the Cabinet to offering up his policy solutions to the grateful nation.
A sinner that repenteth.
What is the significance, do you think, of him putting forward this, given that he was
When he was in the Cabinet office as de facto Deputy Prime Minister, he was in charge of social care policy in the aftermath of the general election where the Tories put forward the dementia tax and then dropped it. It's worth noting that under Damien's stewardship, and he's a good man in many ways, policy ran into the sand. There was a green paper team that was slowly disbanded and nothing really happened. That's now gone over to Jeremy Hunt, who, fantastic act of masochism, has insisted on taking ownership of social care policy, which well done him. But so obviously what Damien Green has got to say on this will be listened to, I'm sure. I just think the number of politicians I know who acknowledge privately that the sensible thing to do is, tax housing a bit more, because we've got a massively inflated property sector that doesn't get taxed properly. That's where we should look for it. The dementia tax, maybe a few design problems, it was about the right approach to take for this stuff. We can't do that because everybody will hate it. We can't possibly have a difficult conversation with the voters about something they might not like.
Anne, property editor, what do you make of the idea of taxing our homes?
Well, it might surprise you to learn that an awful lot of people I speak to in property actually think the whole system should be reformed. Take, for example, stamp duty. A lot of people think instead of asking a rich buyer to pay a whole pile of stamp duty, you should cut it in half and oblige him or her to pay a very high level of council tax for the next 10 or 20 years, thus directly contributing to their local area. Now, we've just seen a series of reforms with an inheritance tax that enables you to leave a house up to the value of £1 million tax-free. Was that the right thing to do?
No.
Or is our wealth, is our housing wealth the natural place for us to pay for our social care in our old age? A great many people think so. Whether they will say so and support initiatives or policies of that kind is another issue.
But the point James is making as well is that politicians trying to square what they think should be done with what can be sold politically. That policy of increasing the inheritance tax threshold to £1 million was the one that George Osborne announced, which stopped Gordon Brown calling a general election in 2007. So it's not, that's how potent it is.
Because the average house is not worth anywhere near that still. It's around about 250,000. But there is this visceral fear of the property-owning classes, people who are relying for their wealth on in old age on their property. They won't have anything built near them. They won't have this principal asset more taxed.
They're more likely to vote than people who don't, who are younger and don't have property. But look to the future, oh politicians. If we've got a generation of people who are going to grow up and aren't able to buy their own houses, they're not going to vote on the basis that you're not taxing property. They won't quite like it if you promise to tax property.
David, presumably they could start taxing your house more and you wouldn't notice. No. You wouldn't anything about it.
Actually, I'm much more traumatised at the moment by the cost of replacing sash windows. I have to tell you, it's absolutely bloody extraordinary. But
and is the government doing anything to help? Are they? No, that's a scandal.
There are two issues here. There's how you fund a particular problem that we have to deal with, i.e. social care, and then there's the general, much more general question of how we raise taxation overall. Or I've always been in favour of maintaining high levels of inheritance tax. I don't believe that inherited wealth is particularly good for anybody, and cutting it doesn't solve any social problem or any other kind of economic problem I think we've ever got. But it is, however, as we know, a large number of people imagine that they could somehow or other fall into the category even when they don't and they couldn't. So here's another thing for your civic education. And the other thing is, and I completely agree, it's not just houses that are a source of wealth, but land is a source of wealth. And wealth is a source of wealth, frankly, wealth you've already got. We have a diminishing base for income tax, the population getting older, but we have a significantly increasing basis for wealth taxing and so on. So we should be taxing differently and we should be taxing more widely. And sooner or later, we're going to have to do that. And then, can I just introduce the concept also when we talk about land? Council tax revaluation, which is what you're talking about.
Let's not rush into that.
Here Jeremy Corbyn, the greatest radical there since George Lansbury in the Labour Party, and you find me one really major radical policy that he's come up with which would actually sort out that not one. There isn't one. Renationalisation doesn't even begin to cut it. Complete tax reform, that would begin to cut it, but it would be hugely difficult. Why? Oh, our friend, everybody who loses anything screams like hell and anybody who gains anything keeps shtum.
Just on the issue of linking wealth and social care, isn't there an unfairness in that some people will quite happily live to a ripe old age, go in the night, never rely on social care. Others will find it's essentially a lottery, they could end up having years and years and years of care. If you link it to wealth, that's it. Your ability to fall, to acquire care is not linked to your income.
That was essentially the key design flaw of the dementia taxes put forward. And it's not my policy. I'm in favour of it because I like to get politicians towards the point where they talk about taxing housing wealth. The differentials of care costs are the big problem. And that's basically why but ultimately life is unfair, and that's why we have a
stick that on your poster.
If you have
a significant long-term cancer problem that renders you disabled, then in that case we expect the state to pick
up absolutely
the
that's why.
But Alzheimer's we don't. This makes no sense. It's not fair. It means it puts you completely up the hazard. We believe in this country in pooled risk, so we pool it.
We provide a pooled remedy. I mean, what you've just described is someone who dies slowly versus someone who dies quickly. compare that to two people in middle age, one of whom is perfectly healthy, one of whom has a chronic condition, requires a lot of hospital treatment. Yeah, that's why we have a universal healthcare system funded by taxation, which means we are essentially removed from the costs of the unfairness, the lottery of life. So I'd rather see some sort of property taxation, whether or not it's higher inheritance tax or capital gains tax on primary residences, maybe levied at the point of death, used to fund a centralised national care system integrated with the NHS. But that's
not
hypothecated either. Don't get me started on hypothecation. Bad idea.
Can I note here that James has just mentioned, he said the unsayable, the idea that there would be capital gains tax on the principal private residence, because the biggest tax break that people in London and the South East have is to be able to sell their primary residence tax-free. Yeah. Now, we've seen creeping rates of capital gains tax on the sale of second homes and rental homes. Every politician would really like to be able to get at those untaxed gains, but none of them from any party could ever speak those words because it would be electoral suicide. Wouldn't you agree with me on that?
Probably, yes.
Maybe 25
generally
years.
I generally find if I agree with something, it's probably a bad idea politically.
right.
I'm the last person you get advice from when I win an election. But equally, I still have this naive belief that maybe, just maybe, the politicians are a bit more honest and a bit more brave. They can stand up and say, look, you're not going to like this. It's difficult, it's painful, but it's a good thing to do.
Developers have been told to hold off putting in planning permission before the council elections in May for fear of that any local politician would be seen to promote development and want more homes built in their area for fear of losing votes.
Well, I'm sure we'll come back to the local elections in May. In a moment, we'll be discussing what David Ivanovich isn't watching at the cinemas. We'll be back after this break. What's that? You wake up every morning wanting to know what's going on in politics and you want it in your inbox just after 8 o'clock with some jokes? Sign up to my morning email briefing, thetimes.co.uk/redbox.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Welcome back to the Red Box podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, joined in the studio by Anne Ashworth, James Kirkup, and this is David Ivanovich.
There's a lot of excitement about the new black superhero movie. Before that, there was a lot of excitement about Wonder Woman. We haven't yet had Gay Tiger Guy or Super Hassid, but those may be a matter of time. And it leaves me all completely cold. These are kids' movies that infantilised adults spend fortunes making, discussing or going to see. They have nearly no redeeming features. Actually, I wrote that earlier. Actually, they have no redeeming features. So stop it already.
Right, so have you seen Black Panther?
No. Well, what would be the point of my saying that these are ridiculous, infantilised movies that no one should go and see, and then I go and see them?
You may have done some research. Has anybody here seen Black Panther?
No.
No, but I've been at the cinema where to see the queues.
I've walked past them as well.
I saw the massive queues of people trying to get into the screening of Black Panther at my local cinema, and there was visible excitement. They were going to hear the Kendrick Lamar soundtrack. They were going to see loads of strong women who weren't strong in all the same kind of way, and there was a palpable excitement about it. Are you not questioning the whole of kind of myth that has been with us since the dawn of time? I mean, you might even start saying that the Iliad and Odyssey were sort of adventure movies that infantilized people. I mean, they are. They're Game of Thrones.
I've never seen David and Odovich. Lost for words.
I'm not lost for words. I'm not lost for words at all. I'm always going to let Anne pull out this absolute ridiculous
Odysseus and a leotard.
Yeah.
Kapow, wham.
The reason why they spend so much money, I think there's something like 30 more of these movies in production right now and so on. It's because Hollywood found it was losing a lot of its money in the domestic box office. So it had to create a stereotype-type picture which succeeds again and again abroad with the minimum of decent dialogue, no ambiguity and so on. Human life is full of ambiguity, and actually, incidentally, there is a lot of bloody ambiguity in the Odyssey and in the Iliad.
And in the original Marvel comics. Now, I'm not going to say I can't defend Black Panther because I haven't seen it. In terms of dialogue, watch The Avengers, written by Joss Whedon. If you want snappy dialogue, that is.
I don't want
good.
Snappy dialogue all the time. Well,
that's what you're complaining about. You're getting snappy dialogue. Go back.
I didn't actually say that.
You probably said it. I don't know. We can edit it to me. You make it. You did. Go back to the original comics. These are based on. I'm not going to defend the films. And I was a teenage geek for a year reading stuff when you were
a teenager.
What on earth is wrong with you?
You're supposed to have got out of that habit by the time you're about 11. And then you go on to something else and spend a vast amount of money. I grew up in the countryside. I'm adding to this by discussing this. But the very fact that our kind of cultural establishment gets into the business of serious discussion about representation in these absolutely worthless movies, which are only people only go to because their friends all go to. Cannibalise each other and extend each other and extend the kind of, you know, the cultural range of
I was 13, I was lonely, I want to add something.
Well, firstly, David gets enough snappy dialogue on the Times comment desk, so he doesn't need to get it when he goes to the cinema. Secondly, I'd like to add Star Wars to this pile. I can't stand Star Wars. And my wife and everyone else in our house is obsessed with it, and to me it's absolute cobblers. Anything with aliens and wizards, people with pointy feet, Harry Potter, all of them. These are children's films that should be watched by children. And the way that adults treat them, like Star Wars high literature, I find maddening.
So, David, when you're on the tube and you see a grown-up reading a Harry Potter book...
Oh, God, I'd move away.
Do you take them to task and say Middlemarch would be better?
There are lots more modern novels and so on, and there are lots more things, even in the kind of adventure genres, which are much more taxing than that and so on. But no, on the whole, I think that that kids' books are for kids and adults' books are for adults. Look, we know that the world is actually a very kind of complicated place. Our emotions are complicated. I think that it is better for adults on the whole to explore the complexity of the universe rather than to self-infantilise and go into the business where black is white and white, where black is black and white is white, and you have a mission and you go ahead and do it in exactly the same way over and over again.
I'm going to try and make the case for Marvel Comics.
Not these movies. We'll have another discussion next time about Marvel Comics.
But moving pictures based on Marvel Comics. I haven't seen Black Panther. I have watched Punisher, the Netflix the Netflix series, but you're based on The Punisher. The Punisher is a comic written in the early 70s, after the Vietnam War, which explores moral ambiguity, right and wrong, intervention, retribution.
So you want to watch something about the Vietnam War?
Watch Punisher on Netflix, because there's an awful lot in there about masculinity, male roles and culture, post-traumatic stress, Western intervention. It's proper grown-up stuff. Right.
So what would you think we should all be going to see at the cinema now? What's the best film you've seen lately?
Oh, Lady Bird is one of the best films that I've seen lately. And if you want to go to the theatre, go and see John, both of which I've seen in the last couple of weeks, and both a few days, and both of which really explore some of these themes. I understand the need for people just to kind of entertain themselves and to cut off, etc. But there are intelligent ways of doing that, and there are intelligent formats for adventure and other things. The superhero movies are just not part of that.
It will be interesting to see if this particularly successful superhero movie, with that is Black Panther, gets anywhere at the Oscars next year, because we perceive the Oscars nowadays as being about art house movies that the bulk of people don't go and see. And it would be very interesting if, because of the huge amounts of money that it has made, this movie, and there are going to be sequels, I hate to say that in front of you, David, whether that Hollywood will reward that success with one of its big gongs.
Well, quite often you're right. Quite often the more obscure, harder to understand and less money a film makes at the cinema, the more likely it is to win the Oscars.
Where is the stuff that makes money? I mean, you're on the sequel point, you're absolutely right. The demise of Hollywood imagination is wonderful. But how many Fast and Furious films have been made so far? I bet you're a Vin Diesel fan.
Oh, I'm a huge, as you can imagine, I'm a huge fan.
It's about 15 of the
things. This is my problem. I do know that one of them was filmed in the Treasury. That's the only thing. They hired out the Treasury and they drove some cars around.
Before Star Wars, the big movies were things like Taxi Driver, The Godfather, and so on. I mean, The Godfather is probably still one of the best movies ever made. Now, that was full of excitement, but it was also full of all these other things as well. And none of these films, for all the money that is spent upon them, is worth even a minute
with the greatest respect, though, Hollywood, the industry that fills cinemas, fills with product, they're not really aiming at you. You're not the key market.
Why does my paper have to be full of bloody reviews of this sort of stuff? And why do we have to do the cultural cringe and pretend to ourselves that it's all of some kind of great cultural significance and importance, and that somehow or other, the moment you have a black superhero is a moment of utter liberation for humanity, when it is no such thing? It is yet another moment that marks the infantilization of the human spirit.
Can I come in here and say Three Billboards is very good, and it's just and apparently it's exactly like rural Missouri. And how do I know this? Because Clayton Crabtree, the wonderfully named designer for Bricks and Mortar, comes from a small town in Missouri, and it is a great, thoughtful film with quite a lot of adventure and a certain amount of moral hazard in it. I think you'll feel better.
I've enjoyed how Redbox has turned into a film review show, but I have a feeling that listeners will have stronger views on this than anything else we've discussed. Let us know what you think. Tweet us at TimesRedbox, post on Facebook, or email us redbox@thetimes.co.uk, and we'll try to share some of your views next week. That's all we've got time for, unfortunately, this episode. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on your Android device, and sign up to my daily morning email at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, from Anne Ashworth, James Kirker, David Ivanovich, and me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.